Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Solving Problems and Selling Ideas with Simple Pictures. We certainly welcome our audience here this evening with us, and we invite you to have a look at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. Dan Rome is the best-selling author of The Back of the Napkin, Solving Problems and Selling Ideas with Pictures. Amazon rated The Back of the Napkin the number 5 best business book of 2008, while Business Week, Fast Company, and The London Times all voted it the best creativity and innovation book of the year. Dan is the founder of Digital Rome, Inc., a management consulting company that helps business executives solve complex problems through visual thinking. He's helped leaders at diverse organizations like Microsoft, Walmart, Boeing, and even the United States Senate. He's been featured on CNN, MSNBC, ABC News, Fox News, and NPR. Dan discovered the power of pictures as a business problem-solving tool in the 1980s when he founded the first marketing communications company in the then Soviet Union. With no Russian language skills, he quickly realized that his business pictures transcended the language barrier. Ever since that eye-opening experience, Dan's been fine-tuning the visual thinking tools he introduces in his book and that he's going to share with us this evening. Dan received 2 degrees at the University of California, Santa Cruz, one in fine art and the second in biology. This combination of art and science started the cross-disciplinary approach to problem-solving that is the backbone of his work and lectures. He's also a licensed pilot and a skill that demands constant practice in understanding visual information displays. He has applied his business-oriented visual thinking skills while living and working in Switzerland, Russia, Thailand, France, Holland, and the U.S. He now lives here in San Francisco. Please join me in welcoming Dan Rome.
Thank you, Tom. Thank all of you for coming. No, let me turn that around. I want to thank you for inviting me to come and share some of my ideas with your club. You know, over the last year or so, since the book has come out, I have had just this extraordinary opportunity to go and share these ideas with this extraordinary array of businesses and organizations. And I have to tell you, many times when I go into these companies, I don't really know a whole lot about what they actually do. So I am not an aeronautical engineer, but one of the highlights of my career was being able to go and share these ideas with the folks at Boeing. And as Tom mentioned, I had an opportunity a few months ago to go and work with the policy committee of the Democratic side of the United States Senate. And after having spent most of a day with the folks who are the policymakers for the Senate, I mean, we had a great time, and I'd like to think that we actually solved some problems. I'll admit I still have no idea what the Senate actually does. But that said, what I have realized is when I go into any one of these businesses or organizations, I have a very simple proposition that I make to them. And that is what I would like to share with you tonight. And the proposition, as I say, it's very simple, and I think it's very powerful, and I believe it to be absolutely true. And it is this. We can solve our problems with pictures. We can solve our problems with pictures. Now, I know this to be true because I have never seen this not to be the case, where the application of a simple picture to help clarify or try to solve a problem has made things worse. It doesn't happen. The use of our innate visual thinking system that we're going to talk about to help us solve problems is fantastic. But I also recognize, you know, in all fairness, I try to put myself in the audience's shoes. If I was sitting down there and someone got up in front of me and said, hey, we can solve our problems with pictures, I would be a little bit dubious, maybe even a little bit skeptical. I would like to think, though, that I would have the presence of mind to say to that person, you know, say something like, Dan, you know, solving problems with pictures, that sounds really good, but I do have 3 questions. The first question is, you know, which problems are we talking about here? The second question is, which pictures are we talking about? And the third question would be, which people are we talking about? You know, namely, who is going to do this? Because goodness knows, most of us are, we're not visual people, right? Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to answer those 3 questions. In fact, I like those 3 questions so much, they're going to be the agenda for the rest of the time that we're going to spend together. And I'm going to give you a very quick little tip. If there's anybody who can't stay for the entire session, I'm going to give you the answer to all 3 of those questions in about the next 3 minutes. So if someone needs to leave, wait for 3 minutes, and then you can go. So which problems are we talking about? Well, the really quick and simple answer is all of them. And I don't say this facetiously. I mean, literally, you could be talking about a strategy problem. You could be talking about a resource allocation problem. You could be talking about a project management problem. Any problem that we have the ability to articulate at all, we have the ability to articulate infinitely more clearly, if not outright solve, through the use of a picture. Well, okay, so now let's move on to question number two. Now, if these pictures can help us solve any problem, these pictures have to be really sophisticated, right? I mean, they must take years of training and artistic talent and probably some really fancy computer software to create. Well, absolutely not. And in fact, what I'd like you to do, everybody should have a napkin now, and I hope people do have some kind of a writing instrument. I'm going to ask you to write. First, we're going to start on the front of our napkin. If you can figure out which side's the front of the napkin, what I'd like you to do is practice with me. These are the pictures that we're going to need to be able to draw. If you can draw a square, if you can draw a circle, if you can draw an arrow connecting them, and here's the trickiest one of all, if you can draw a stick figure, and for extra credit, make it smiley, you can draw every picture that we're going to be talking about, which automatically starts to answer this third question, doesn't it? I mean, who's going to do this? If you all drew on your napkins, we've just proved that we are all going to be able to do this. And there's a couple of interesting things I just want to comment on for a moment. I can guarantee, I mean, there are some people in this room who think, this may sound good, but I'm not a visual thinker. I like to set the bar really low. If you were visual enough to walk into this room and find a place to sit down without falling down, you are visual enough to understand everything that we're going to talk about. Close to, as near as we can estimate, the neurobiologists and neuroscientists, about 75% of the neurons in our brain that are processing sensory information. So not all of the processing we're doing, but the processing of everything that's coming in that tells us the way the world is. 75% is dedicated to vision, which tells us a couple of things. It tells us, number one, that vision must be very complicated, and it is. We are only now beginning to kind of understand how vision works. But number two, it tells us that vision must be critically important to us. And it is. I mean, vision is the fundamental way, especially when we are infants, that we are learning to make our way through the world. In fact, there was a study that I was just reading about last week in New Scientist magazine, some really literally breaking information in neurobiology, that in the first 4 months of an infant's life, most all of the development of the brain is taking place in the centers that control vision and movement. That is the first way that we understand our way through the world primarily. Of course, the other senses are critical as well, but vision is so critical to us. And the ironic thing is, well, let me ask you this. How many people in here, and there are a couple I already know, have kids who have been through kindergarten or are presently in kindergarten? How many people in here themselves have been through kindergarten and made it through? Well, now, here's something to think about. Imagine this. Go into a kindergarten class, and of course, with the teacher's permission, ask the little six-year-olds two questions. Ask them how many of you can draw, and every hand is going to go up. And then ask the same little kindergartners, and how many of you can read and write? And maybe two hands are going to go up, but they're not really sure that they know what you're talking about. And now imagine coming back to the same class 10 years later, 16-year-olds in 10th grade, and ask the same two questions. How many of you can draw? Well, maybe three or four hands are going to go up. How many can read and write? Every hand's going to go up. Now, don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with reading and writing. I mean, that's absolutely critical. We need that. But what is wrong is that this system that is so amazing that we are born with, that is such a powerful presence in how we navigate the world, is not something that from the time we're about age six, anybody ever encourages us to continue to develop and try to understand. So who's going to do it? Well, that's my long answer. I guess I took longer than 3 minutes. We are all going to do this. Now, I want to share with you a couple of underlying rules that I have discovered or thought about or worked with people to help others discover as we've been going through all of these different meetings and workshops that I've been able to be involved with. And I'm going to call these the kind of the unwritten rules of visual problem solving. And I'm going to call rule number one the following. Whoever best describes the problem is the person who is most likely to solve it. Now think about that for a moment. The problem could be anything. The problem could be, how are we going to address the present economic climate? The problem might be, how are we going to address the present environmental climate? The problem might be, how am I going to get to the airport on time tomorrow to catch my plane? Whatever the problem is, the person who's able to articulate, what are the pieces of the problem? What is the definition of the problem? What are the players? What are the moving pieces? How do they fit together? Just in defining the problem is already the person most likely who is pretty close to understanding or grasping what the solution might be. So the mercenary subtext to this rule is, literally, whoever draws the best picture is going to get the funding. And I've seen this take place many, many times, especially in a business setting. Because if you really think about it, if someone goes and asks for money, if they've got a problem that they want to solve and they need to get funded, and they say, the problem is I want to fix the fact that our roads are not very good. Okay, well, what if someone came in and they had a drawing that indicated exactly what they thought the problem was and exactly what they thought they might be able to do? The money's going to go to the second person. I want to give you an example. I start with a Southwest Airlines napkin. How many people in here know the story of how Southwest Airlines was founded? Southwest Airlines was founded on the back of a napkin. Roland King and Herb Kelleher, two guys sitting in Texas, 1967, St. Anthony's Club in San Antonio. We're talking about businesses. Roland took a napkin, drew a triangle on it, connecting Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio, said, let's make an airline that does that. Herb said, it's a great idea. And they started Southwest Airlines. Now, as we know, since that time, Southwest is the most profitable airline that has ever existed. And as of a month ago, I could be wrong, the last time I checked, a month ago, Southwest was the only airline presently profitable in the United States. And, of course, that's all due to the fact that it was started on the back of a napkin. But that's not the story I wanted to tell you. The story is I had to fly from San Francisco out to D.C. to go talk to the Democratic policy team of the United States Senate. They'd asked me to come out and see if it wouldn't be possible in the fever of the end of the election season, this was in September of last year, to see if there wasn't some possibility of clarifying some of the messages through the use of pictures, or at least conceptually. And whenever I go and give one of these talks, I like to try to find examples from the industry or from the practice of the people that I'm going to be talking to. And so I thought, I don't know of any great political stories or political ideas that were illustrated on the back of a napkin or on a quick sketch. And so I started to do the research to see what I could find out, and I found out some interesting things. This is a picture of Mount Vernon, George Washington's estate. And does anyone want to guess who drew the picture? George drew the picture. I didn't know this. George was trained as a surveyor and a map maker, and he apparently drew all the time. And if you go through his notebooks, there are lots and lots of pictures in them. I thought that was interesting. Who else in politics? Here we have one. This is White House stationery. Someone's drawing a boat. Someone's drawing what looks like a chessboard and maybe an eraser next to it, and Fidel Castro in a box and blockade Cuba. Someone is drawing feverishly. Who would that be? That was Kennedy, of course, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Anyone want to guess? Nixon, you got it. Which one of the presidents, and what problem was he trying to solve? You got to ask. I mean, I look at this picture and I say, what's going on down here? I mean, there are obviously some issues there, but here's an easy one. Anyone want to guess who drew these pictures? Ronnie drew those pictures. Of course he did, when he was in his cabinet meetings. And that's a true fact. So when I was done with my presentation to the Democrat, essentially this group was the chiefs of staff of the Democratic senators. And, you know, I've often wondered if I had received the call from the Republican side of the Senate, would I have responded? And they didn't ask, so I didn't have to go through the torture of thinking that through. But when I was done, a guy named Doug Steiger, who's the head of policy development for the Democratic side of the Senate, came up to me and said, Dan, I have the perfect back-of-the-napkin political story for you. And it comes down to this gentleman, a guy named Arthur Laffer. Anybody know who Arthur Laffer is? Anybody heard that name? Okay. My brother, be quiet. So what happened is Arthur Laffer, thank you, Carl. Arthur Laffer, in 1974, was sitting in a bar, it's always in a bar, with two guys, and they were talking about economics. And on the back of a napkin, Arthur Laffer drew the following picture. He said, let me draw you something. And he drew an XY axis chart. And on the horizontal axis, he said, imagine that this is the percent tax rate that the U.S. government charges from 0% to 100%. And on the vertical axis, we're going to represent the amount of money that the government actually collects from those taxes, from zero money up to lots and lots and lots of money. Now, it stands to reason that if the government is charging 0% tax, it's going to collect zero revenue. But it also stands to reason, says Mr. Laffer, Dr. Laffer, if the government charges 100% tax, it's also going to collect zero money because no one will work. If the government's going to take 100% of your earnings, no one will work. So then he drew something called that came to be known as the Laffer curve that goes like this. And what he said is at some point, what actually happens is dropping the tax rate increases the amount of money that the government collects. And the two gentlemen that he was with were very intrigued by this napkin sketch, and they asked if they could keep it. And they took it back to their boss, who was then President Gerald Ford. And it turns out that those two guys that Arthur Laffer was sitting with are these two guys, both of whom were chiefs of staff of President Ford. Those two guys, of course, are these two guys. And who says a napkin sketch does not have influence and the ability to convey power? That napkin sketch, Laffer's sketch on the back of that napkin in that bar, became literally the basis of supply-side economics. It got passed from Ford onto the Reagan team and all the economic team, and the model became dropping the tax rate increases the amount of money that we collect. Now, there are lots and lots of interpretations of the Laffer curve. That's not the point. That was the interpretation that they drew from that particular picture, and that became economic policy, essentially, up until today. Now, we're moving along. Does anyone want to guess who drew this picture? President Barack Obama drew this picture. It turns out that our president draws all the time. Now, an interesting little nuance is that he is left-handed, which doesn't in and of itself mean anything, but there does appear to be some kind of correlation for people who are left-handed to be potentially more spatial in their thinking as opposed to more linear and verbal in their thinking. And we certainly know that our president is very good on the verbal side, but I'm very intrigued by his ability on the spatial and the pictorial side, which he obviously has a talent for. Because I would like to ask the president if he could draw me a picture of what a stimulus looks like. What does that actually look like? I need the picture. Because all we know, and by the way, I think I'm for the stimulus, but I'm not really sure because, frankly, all I know about the stimulus is how big it is. The only thing I know about it is how big it is. I don't know what's the strategy behind it. I don't know what's the vision behind it. I don't mean to undermine it, but I don't know. I think a picture would help me because the only thing we know about the stimulus, and you're going to have to help me get the right number of zeros in here because I get bad at this. We'll start with the pennies, and then we'll go through the hundreds, and then we'll go through the thousands, and then we'll go through the millions, and then we'll go up to 787. The only thing we know is how big it is. I'm asking, where is the picture? And then I'm asking any one of these people, where is the picture? Because it's really interesting if you listen to the testimony and you watch these people talking. Hank Paulson and Timothy Geithner in particular are clearly brilliant guys. And as you watch them talk, especially Hank Paulson, it's as if he is trying to draw you the picture of what he's talking about. And I'm saying, okay, stop the hand-waving. Why not just take the whiteboard or take a piece of paper and draw me the Venn diagram of what the stimulus is supposed to do? Any one of you, where is my picture? And I thought, it must be somewhere, right? We don't pass a trillion-dollar law without somebody having the picture of what it where it goes. So I went to the stimulus package, and I went to the Senate site, and I downloaded the Senate version of the stimulus package. This is not the final version that was passed, but it's pretty close. And I thought, well, okay, I don't see any picture on the first two pages, but then this is a very serious government document, so they're not going to put any pictures on the first couple of pages. It must be further in. So I started going through it. And I started going through it. And I started going through it. And when I finally got to the end, there are no pictures. In fact, if you look through the law of the stimulus, all it is seven, this is an interesting number, 778 pages. You don't go there yet. 778 pages of a bullet list that gives amounts allocated to particular groups. That's all it is. There is nothing in the stimulus law that says this money is contingent on meeting this particular goal or integrating with this particular other aspect of some other government program. It is literally a list of this $100 million is going to go to that program. That's all it is. No wonder they could debate it. There is no picture behind it. There may be, but we have certainly not been told what it is. The thing that I find interesting, and you saw in the number, 778 pages representing $787 billion. Effectively, what we're looking at here is a request for proposal where each page is about $1 billion worth of ask. Now, I know when I'm doing consulting work, if I'm going to ask a client for $500, I will include some kind of little picture that says what we're actually going to do with it or why that amount of money, where that came from. This is 778 pages of $1 billion requests. And I would really love to know, obviously, what is the picture? Now, here's the thing that's kind of interesting, is we could say, well, there's no picture in there because nobody had time to create one. Well, I'm not, for reasons we're going to talk about later, that's not a valid argument. It's faster to actually create the picture than it is to try to write out all those bullet lists. There's also an issue about the amount of detail. The picture can't convey the amount of detail we need. These are all valid concerns. But what I have been able to find is, in any typical meeting situation, now I work in business, so I primarily am talking about business meetings. And I've done a little survey. We don't have time to do it tonight, but I have done this survey hundreds of times, and what I have found is that there is a kind of a spectrum along which all of us fall that determines the type of visual thinker we are, or visual problem solver that we are. And the spectrum basically goes like this. About 25%, about a quarter of the people in any typical business meeting are what I'm going to call a black pen person. And I call them that because these are the people who can't wait to take the black pen and run up to the whiteboard and say, ah, okay, the moment the meeting starts, we know these people, there's some of you in here. You know, this is what the problem's really about. Right? We got it? Those are the black pen people. Then we have what I'm going to refer to, about half the people in the room are the yellow pen people. We can call those the highlighter people. And these are the people, these are those of us who are kind of sitting back, letting someone else draw, and then we'll say this, we'll do exactly this. We'll say, you know, I can't draw, but what's really interesting, black pen person, about your picture is what's really actually the thing that's most interesting would be for us to look in here, because I think what happens over here is that's the area where we actually have the greatest amount of concern. These are the people that are really good at someone else looking at someone else's picture and identifying the critical areas in it that are worth exploring. If we add these up, that's 75%. We've still got one quarter of the audience. What do? They're what we're going to call the red pen people. And I like to think that this little picture is a fairly accurate representation, because this is the person who's sitting there saying, this is all a bunch of crap. You know, this is so grossly oversimplifying the problem, this is actually making the problem worse. These idiots up at the whiteboard have no idea what they're talking about. This is wrong. Now, it is the red pen person who is the person who does have the greatest grasp of the details and the facts of the issue. This is the person that probably wrote that bullet list. They really do get it. The trouble is, because there are so many details and facts, it's very, very difficult for them to try to put it into a way that other people are going to be able to understand it. And we need, if we're going to get a good problem-solving picture, we need the contribution of that red pen person. The way you do that, and if you consider yourself a red pen person, if you're the kind of person who doesn't really appreciate brainstorming sessions and whiteboard drawing, you're about a quarter of the typical audience, that's fine. The rest of the people need you to participate. If you're a red pen person, close your ears for a moment, because here's the secret for how the black pen and yellow pen people get them to happen. You've got to get the red pen person so pissed off that what they finally do is they go to the board and they say, no, 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 no. The actual issue is what's going on over here. That's what we need to focus on. And now guess what? We've got the problem-solving picture that we needed. You just had to get them up there to do it. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands here who we have. Well, why not? How many people just would consider themselves, I can't wait to get up to the whiteboard and start drawing person? Anybody in here? Okay, it's about a third of the room. How many people would consider themselves, and I can't draw, but, and are willing to work off of someone else's picture? How many people would consider themselves a red pen person? There are more details here than we can. Okay, it's reasonable. The bell curve is kind of holding. But the real question I have then is, if we have this range of talents and abilities in the way that we can think visually, why is it that every time we go to see a presentation done that's related to an organization or to a business, we get that? Every single time we get into death, I hate even repeating this, we get death by PowerPoint. Now, as I mentioned, and we're going to talk about this later, Microsoft is a client of mine, and I actually enjoy working with Microsoft, even though I'm an Apple person since 1984. I was really terrified to go up to Redmond because, you know, as an Apple person, I know that that's the den of evil and all of that. It's actually not. I really enjoy working with the people up in Microsoft. That said, I'm going to make fun of them today. Is there anybody here from Microsoft? Everything I'm going to share with you about Microsoft has been approved for public consumption, so I'm not going to give anything away. But the real point is, and I think probably many of us are aware of this, it is true that in the context of trying to convey information to someone in real time, just about the worst way that you can do it from a cognitive perspective is by creating a PowerPoint deck that looks something like this. It is impossible for the human brain, really, for most of us, to get anywhere beyond about this far in paying attention to what the person is telling us. From that point on, everything's pretty much a wash, unless something is so outlandishly different or unexpected that it encourages our limbic brain, which we're going to talk about in a little while, our emotional response center, to kind of wake up again and tell us what's going on. But the real irony here is, how many of us have ever been in a convention or a conference where someone will start the death by PowerPoint routine, and we'll all groan, and we'll make our way through it, and then we'll get up when it's our turn to talk and do exactly the same thing? It's really kind of crazy. We're going to talk about some other tools that we have, and the most important one, I really do believe, is that we are on the dawn of just saying a new era. It's an era that we've already had. We're just going to do it again, I hope. Where we do recognize the ability that we have. We don't need the software. And I'm no Luddite. I love computers. I mean, I'm a total geek. But when it comes to thinking through an idea on our own or working out an idea with our team in real time, live, or even remotely, or then conveying that idea to other people, sometimes the software that we use actually inhibits us from doing what we naturally do extremely well. And we don't need the software for all of those times. So what I'd like to do now, I mean, enough for the time being of my just talking about this, I would like to show you how I go about creating a back-of-the-napkin sketch. So I would like you to take your napkins, and if you have something to draw with, if you don't, you can follow along. The way that I recommend, I insist on starting any problem-solving picture is very simple. I mean, we're sitting there looking at this blank napkin, and at the moment we do, our brain just goes, what am I supposed to do? Well, I'm going to tell you what you can do every single time so you don't even have to think about it. The first thing is to draw a circle and give it a name. And in this case, I want you to call it me. And for extra credit, go ahead and make it look a little bit like you if you'd like. What we have done, it's not just that we've broken the pristine surface of the canvas, which is part of it, which is good because now our brain is willing to go forward, but by identifying, just drawing that first circle and giving it a name, almost invariably the thing that we're going to want to call that circle is the thing that's the top of our mind or the thing that we're closest to, and almost more invariably that it's going to be me, or it's going to be my company, or it's going to be my division, or it may be my competitor, or it's something. Whatever we put down is the title for the first idea. We can change it later, but it's something that's going to readily come to mind. Now, on our little napkin, I want you to then draw a second circle and make this one kind of big and kind of fluffy. And our brain is now saying, okay, what's that one going to be? I wonder. Well, let's call that one my problem. And we're going to hold our napkin for a little bit. But automatically, what's happening, we can't avoid it. Our visual processing systems are starting to wonder, what's the connection between these two? It can't help it. And it is doing it in a way that it would not do if I had just told you, say my problem and say me. More is happening now. We are opening up more processing centers. Before we go back to the napkin, I want to show you a problem, an example of that big fluffy circle that we just drew that I did have an opportunity to work on where we used the kind of pictures I'm talking about to actually help solve a problem. And I thought that we would talk about something complex. A friend of mine graduated a year and a half ago from the Harvard Business School. Bill Gates gave the commencement address, and my friend sent me this quote from Bill Gates' address because he thought I would find it interesting. Now, Mr. Gates was not talking about Microsoft, nor was he talking about software. He was talking about the Gates Foundation and philanthropic giving. But what he said was interesting. Mr. Gates said, the barrier to change is not too little caring, it is too much complexity. To turn caring into action, and this is the part I really liked, we need to see a problem, We need to see a solution, and we need to see the impact. But complexity blocks all three steps. To which I say, Mr. Gates, you're absolutely right. You couldn't have said it better. It's an unfair dig, but what we're looking at now is a screenshot of Microsoft Word 6.0 from probably about 4 years ago. If you were to open up every menu in Microsoft Word, this is what you would see. Now, keep in mind, the name of the application is Word, so it's very nice that we've been given left this amount of space to actually do the words. The problem is a problem of complexity. And just on a side note, just to prove that I'm not intending to diss Microsoft on this, having had a chance to now work with them, I realized that for people, you know, when we get into the schism between Apple and Microsoft, the issue comes down to a fundamental philosophy of the businesses, is my interpretation. And everybody that I've met at Microsoft does have, I would call it, a true engineering mindset. And the idea is, if there are multiple solutions to a problem, I owe it to you, the user of this application, to give you every single option. I owe you that. I have found this solution. You must have it too. You might need it. And so what ends up happening is, if there are 15 ways to print out of Word, all 15 ways will be enabled. Now, the other folks down in Cupertino say there may be 15 ways to print out of Word, but we're going to give you one, and it will be our way. And the difference is the perceived simplicity of the interface. And it's not just the perceived simplicity, it's the outright simplicity of it. And, you know, you could go into more deeper philosophical discussions about which way is right, but in my estimation, that's the real difference. Now, the real interesting thing for me was the project that I want to share with you was for the Microsoft Finance Group. And Chris Liddell, who is the CFO at Microsoft, had asked a team of his people to think about what might happen if we were able to create a kind of a prototype that would help our financial analysts more quickly be able to parse through this extraordinary amount of data that we collect on a daily basis to be able to more quickly get really, really good insights out of that data. I mean, there are people. Are there any people in here who spend their days looking at spreadsheets like this? There are people who are true spreadsheet jockeys, and I met many of them, and they're amazing. There are people who are able to say, I understand that looking at this cell and comparing it to this cell and pivoting it in this particular way to give me this piece of information actually delivers me a really fundamental piece of insight about how this business ought to be operating. But not very many people are good at that. That, combined with the fact that we recognize that in a few years, all of us in our desktop or our laptop machines will have what is essentially the equivalent of today's high-end gaming platform. I mean, that's the way hardware gets sold. We're always upgrading our machines. So would it be possible to come up with a more visually interesting way of looking at this that would make it more useful for a broader range of people? Now, what happened is Mr. Liddell's team asked us if we could create a prototype to show what that might look like. Pure blue sky thinking. It's never going to be a product, but just something to think about. But the problem was we were given about 7 weeks to build that prototype because there was a conference coming up. So I don't know if anybody in here has ever built software or created software, but the right way to do this would have been to spend a long time going out and interviewing hundreds of people who are experts in this field who really use these tools to find out exactly what they do, exactly what's important, and how does it all work. We had about 2 weeks to do that because we sort of mapped backwards. If we had 7 weeks, we were going to need 5 weeks just to do the programming of the prototype. It gave us 2 weeks to figure out what the thing would be. So we made an alternate suggestion. I said, instead of going out and doing lots of interviews, why don't we just take 12 or 15 of the very best financial analysts you have and lock them in a room for 2 days, and we're going to whiteboard out what the problem is, and we're going to figure out what our interface will be in those 2 days. And they said, okay. So that's what we did. We locked ourselves in the room, and I want to show you what were the pictures that we created. And we started it exactly the same way you just started that little napkin sketch. We drew some circles, and we gave them names, and they happened to be the cast of characters that are going to play out in this drama, this financial analysis paralysis cycle. We have the CFO and two presidents. Presidents just happen to be the title that are given to heads of major divisions. And then we start to say, okay, what happens with these people? On a quarterly basis, the CFO calls together the two presidents, and he says, tell me how your business is doing. And there's a really lovely term they use up there. I don't know if other businesses do. I'd never heard it before. He said, show me the rhythm of business. I really like that, the ROB. I want to know your ROB. So we all know how this works. President number one says, we had a really great quarter last quarter, but next quarter is going to be a disaster. And president number two says, we had a terrible quarter last quarter, but next quarter is going to be great. And the CFO looks at this and he says, well, that's fine, but you guys aren't comparing the same thing. These metrics don't align. I can't make any good decisions. Get out of here. Come back when you can give me three things. I need metrics that match. I need better backward-looking analysis on these aligned metrics so that we can have better forward-looking estimations and insights as to where we're going to go. So until you can give me those three things, get out of here. So what happens then is those two presidents sit down and say, oh, my gosh, what are we going to do? He's asking for everything. Well, they say, let's give him everything. So they go back to their offices, collect everything, and bring it back, and the cycle starts over again. So he said, okay, that's the problem. That's what happens. So where could we break this cycle? And we thought, well, let's break it at this point. And instead of saying, let's just give him everything, let's use that software magic to find a way to be able to give him everything, but in such a way that he can pick what he wants to look at. And so we came up with this idea, okay, of let's create what we're going to call a financial portal. Anybody's familiar with this? The idea that in a single interface, we'll be able to pull in multiple sources of data and have it be visible and visual in multiple different kinds of ways. So this, I can't tell you a whole lot more about the details of it, but suffice it to say the idea was we'll have lots of visual displays of information presented either in tree maps or in geographic maps, what have you. And we'll have the actual data behind it, and it will be this interface that the CFO or anybody else can look at and work with. That's all I can really tell you about the particular application, but the point I wanted to make is the pictures that I have just shown you, this big whiteboard picture and this notebook page, are the exact pictures that we created and showed to the executives up at Microsoft. And I've got to tell you, I was pretty scared going into the executive review meeting to show them these pictures because they are not professional. They're not clean. They're not polished. But we didn't have time to do anything else. So I said, you know, let's just try it. So these are the pictures that we showed them. And something remarkable happened in the meeting. Nobody got bogged down in the details. Nobody said, you've used the wrong typeface. Nobody said, I don't like that color. Nobody said, you've collected the wrong data. I mean, look at this data. You can't read it. It's a bunch of squiggles. What happened is because the picture was hand-drawn, and I don't know the cognitive reasoning behind this. I have lots of theories, but I don't know. But because it was hand-drawn, and because it was loose, and because it didn't look finished, and because it didn't look polished, the level of participation from the people in the room was just extraordinary. And after, I had two executives from Microsoft come up to me and say, you know, Dan, we really liked the way that meeting went. We really liked those pictures. What software did you use to create them? And I kind of thought they're being a little bit facetious, so I kind of facetiously said back, well, you know, that was Gray Matter 1.0 and Pen and Paper 1.0, and they said, okay, who makes that? And I thought, well, this is really the issue, isn't it? I mean, I don't mean to stand here and criticize software. That's not the point, but we don't always need it. And so the rule, the underlying rule, if we have a rule we can take away from this, is this. The more human your picture, the more human the response. I do not have the scientific data or understanding to know why, but I'll tell you this, it works. And what it is recognizing that it seems that we like to look at things that align to the way that we see the world. I want to go very quickly through what I mean by that. I'd like you to look at this picture for a moment. I'm not going to give you a lot of time. Don't worry about what you see and what you don't see, because I'm going to show you later on. But then, this, by the way, is down at the Marina Green. See the bridge? You know them. You've seen them down there every time. Here's another picture. I'm going to jump back to the first one really quickly. This is picture one. This is picture two. Does everybody agree that something is happening? Okay, here comes picture number three. Here's picture number three. Something has happened. Does everybody agree that something has happened? And here's picture number four. Something else has happened. It's not really important what happened because I want to share with you a little bit of what just happened in our brain. It turns out that when we see things, and this is neurobiologically valid, our vision system breaks the visual information out there in the world into a number of different work streams, if you will, that are called the pathways of vision. And one of those pathways is called the what pathway. Another pathway is called the where pathway. Another one is called the how pathway. Essentially what's happening is our brain is working both in serial and in parallel. So that means things are happening sequentially and things are happening at the same time, where the process, the work of trying to understand the visual world around us is broken down into these discrete processing centers that do one or two things really well, but that's all that they do. And I want to take you through my own theory that's applied on top of this, but I have vetted it with the head of cognitive and neurobiology up at UC Davis, Dr. Leo Chalupa. We've talked this through, and he says, Dan, you're going out on a limb here, but it's okay. It's not completely, there's nothing fundamentally flawed in it, so run with it. So I want to take you through this theory. And Dr. Chalupa, if you heard that, I've now just incriminated you. Go back to your napkin now. What we're going to do is we're going to divide our problem up into six pieces that reflect essentially the six fundamental ways that we actually see the world around us. So go ahead and divide it up into six. And I'm going to take you through this pretty quickly, what the six are. The first thing that we did is the what pathway identified all of the objects in our field of view. So go ahead and write the who and the what. It identified the objects. At the same time, while the objects were being named and identified, the quantities of them were being cataloged by a different part of the brain. We're going to call that the how much slice. One part identified, there is a dog. It's dog. The other part said six or two or one. The where pathway, going into a completely different part of the brain, doesn't care what any of those things are. All it cares about is where stuff is. Doesn't care what the stuff is. It just wants to know where it is. What is the physical relationship in space between object A and object B and between both those objects and myself? The when pathway actually adds up all of those and deduces the passage of time. It turns out that one of the ways we recognize the passage of time is actually watching the physical change in the where of the what's that we had identified. Does that make any sense? That if you now know who I am, your brain registers me as a what, that what that's called Dan, and I'm here. I'm this distance from you. Now, as you're watching me, your brain is saying time is passing, and I know that because the where is changing. It's the same what. Dan's not changing, but his position is time is passing. And this is one of the primary ways that we actually measure the passage of time. If you deny your sense of sight, this is true of all our senses, but sight seems to be pretty critical in this. If we deny our sense of sight, one of the first things we lose is the sense of the passage of time. One of the ways that we keep track of it is this. This is what our when pathway is doing. The next is the how, which is the deduction of cause and effect. Based by watching lots of whens take place, we recognize, we build models. If dog sees bird, birds fly off. As dog intersects moving baby carriage, panic ensues. We've now just built a little cause and effect model of how the world works. That's our how slice. And our last slice is the why. Why does this happen? We deduce from having seen lots of these hows how the world works. And in this particular case, we're going to deduce dog loves bird. Bird does not love dog. And this is one of the primary ways in which we build our own models, our cognitive models of how the world works. Okay, so you're saying to me, Dan, that's really cool. So what? What does that have to do with drawing pictures on napkins? Here's the beauty of it. I thought, and this is where we go off into the theoretical never-never land, but this helps me. And I found this to be one of the areas when I give these talks to different people in different organizations that people really gravitate towards. There's something in here that feels right. If we see the world according to roughly these six ways, it stands to reason that we ought to be able to represent anything that we see in a corresponding set of six ways. So I want to take you through what that means. If the problem that we've identified is a who-what problem, who is that person, what is that object, the picture that we would draw to represent that problem is a very simple portrait. Maybe it's a little smiley face, maybe it's a little box. We just draw a little picture of that object. That's the only picture we need to draw. Here's a set of portraits, each one of which is very different. We look at them, we have a different reaction. Here's an interesting little portrait. This is a visual representation of the second most important financial decision that Americans will make. Automatic or manual? If the problem we face is a how much, do we have enough money to make it through the next quarter? The picture that we will draw to reflect that is a chart. Here's the price of tea in China. Here is a breakdown typically of those different types of visual thinking that we have. A little chart. If our problem is where are things located, what we will draw is a simple little map. Little river, X marks the spot, and here's our hut. A map could show where pieces go. A map could show where pieces sit and how they interact. It could be within a business. A map can show where the pieces go and where they intersect. If the problem that we have is when, what do we need to do to make sure that we get all these things done on time? Our deadline is there. When do we need to have everything take place so that we meet our deadline? The picture that we draw is a timeline. When Kennedy in 1969 said, where, we're going there, and we're doing it by 1969, he gave the when. We're doing it by the end of this decade. That's fine. That's something, that's a vision. That's a nice picture everybody can understand, unless you happen to work for NASA, at which point you say, if we're going to do that, when does everything need to happen in us for us to be able to achieve that objective of time? We make a timeline. If you want to make a lot of conversation, you can make your timeline go in a circle. If our problem is how, what is the cause and effect? How am I going to actually get this done? I draw a little flowchart. And here's a very simple flowchart that shows how the brain works. Sensory information comes in. It gets processed in our reptilian brain for very simple actions and behaviors, and we execute those behaviors and actions. Because we are humans, we are mammals, we have something over the crocodiles. The crocodiles can only do that much. We have this neocortex on top that allows us to do a whole lot more sophisticated processing of the sensory information and behave in a lot more sophisticated ways sometimes. The last one, and this is the mother of all problem-solving pictures, the most tricky, is, and I hate this term, we're going to call it a multivariate plot. And what we're essentially doing is we're creating an XY axis against which we can plot multiple types of data. So what a multivariable plot, all it really is mapping together in a single structure, in a single dimensional framework, lots of different types of data. And out of that, we are able to start to draw inferences about how these things interact. And I want to give you one, and then we'll close, and we'll have time for a few questions. I want to give you one example of a Y multivariable plot. And the question that we're going to discuss is, why are we happier on sunny days? And for anyone who is in here as a data purist, you're going to take me to task for mixing up causation and correlation, and you're going to have to forgive me because that's something that's a much bigger conversation. But here's why we like sunny days. Is because let's map time to number of pies that are available to our relative level of happiness. And what we find is that in the winter, there is no fruit available, which means that we are not able to have any pies. And so we are not happy. But in summer, when there is lots of fruit available, that means we are able to have lots of pies, and our intersection point is here, and we are very, very happy. And that's the reason, and I'm sticking with it, that sunny days make us happy, because that's when we have more pies. And with that, I'm going to close with one final thought. I would ask you, I mean, this stuff actually really, truly does work. And it's shocking how rarely in business or even in politics, the simple use of a picture, a simple picture, is so rarely used, and it should be. I think one of the real issues in particular in the political side is that when you draw a picture, you are actually, heaven forbid, going to be clear in your thinking. And often I think, especially in the case of political issues, there is an enormous fear of being clear because then you will be accountable. And the fact is, if you really want someone to understand what you're talking about, if that is what you want them to do, if you really want them to get what you're talking about, the next time you have a problem of whatever sort it is, take a piece of paper, draw that first circle, give it a name, and then go ahead and see what your next circle might be. And with that, I thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
I want to thank Dan Rome, who's been talking to us about solving problems and introducing ideas with pictures. Absolutely fascinating, Dan. Thanks so much. And we do have some time for some questions, and maybe I'll just lead off with one. I was particularly struck with the more human the picture, the more human the response. And the reason I say that is not only the complexity thing, but also the formality thing, or I guess maybe that's the same thing, where when groups of people get together to figure something out, it's always a question, what really is getting in our way? And if we can just, quote, unquote, get real. So yeah. I'd like you to just share some additional thoughts about that issue, about this more human the picture, the more human the response, and why you have seen through some of the work you've done with organizations, why that has been sort of breakthrough-ish.
Well, Tom, you nailed it. And I don't know. I don't think anybody yet knows what is the reason. It is something that I have just witnessed so many times that I'm now starting to believe it. And I never see this fail. And my intention here is not to undermine the use of software, because I love using drawing applications and things like that. But what I have found is in some of these pictures that look very loose and unfinished, and I've tested this, the reaction that I'll get from the person I'm working with is completely different in the level of their participation, but even beyond that, their willingness to accept that I might have made a mistake without criticizing me than if I had made exactly the same picture in a program that made all of the lines straight. I don't know what it is. Is it the fact that it looks human, which makes us more willing to kind of suspend some level of criticism? Or maybe it's the fact that it doesn't look finished. And when something's finished, we hate to question it. Whereas if it looks like it's a work in progress, we're more than happy to question it. And what I have found is the questioning then doesn't become one of criticism, but actually one of support. Because now we are working together on this same sort of half-baked idea, rather than you're rejecting my fully baked idea. And I'm sure someone will come up with some, you know, study someday about maybe there's some validity to it. I don't know.
You said that all napkin drawing happens in a bar. Does that mean that alcohol contributes to the napkin drawing, more specifically creative thinking while drawing?
What do you think? That seems like a politically laden question. It certainly would seem to, it seems to be true. Let's put it this way. Because from the time we get out of kindergarten, most people are not encouraged to draw, that I would bet most people in this room, would be my guess, are pretty intimidated by the idea of trying to draw their idea out. How would I start? I'm going to be criticized. It's going to look terrible. And as we know, alcohol does release a lot of those inhibitions. So it's got to be part of it, is that I feel a lot more fluid and free in my crazy harebrained scheme and sharing them with you, you know, when I'm slightly lubed up, would be my guess. But, I mean, I don't want to establish causation or correlation on that one, but it does seem to be pretty constant.
Hi, Dan.
Hi.
I was just wondering how you overlay storyboarding and telling a story with using these great visuals in this half-baked sort of way, and do you have any tips for the audience around that?
Well, it's a perfect question because, I mean, if you think about storyboarding, the most frequent use of storyboarding, of course, is in the creation of films. At least that's how we do it now. And what's happening is the idea, you all understand storyboarding, is if I have a story to tell, rather than saying it through a series of words, I will actually create a series of simple pictures to indicate whatever it might be. You know, my guy standing here like this, and then a few moments later, you know, he's running like heck to get out of there, and then a few minutes later, you know, he's lying down. I could have told you that, but by showing it through a series of pictures, it's very clear exactly what I'm talking about. One of the things we don't have time to discuss now is that if you think about those six ways that we see the world, this model, I have found it to be a useful model. I'm not saying it's always true and that it's invariant, but it does seem to work often. It's that addition of when. I have my objects, and I've located them in a particular place in space. When is represented often by the change of their position in space. I don't want to get too theoretical, but when lends many of these pictures to wanting to be animations. Or in the case of us who are using PowerPoint all the time, we can't make animations. If we want to describe a really complex picture to someone, our usual bent is just to show them the complex picture and hope that they get it. But they won't. It's deer in the headlights moment. When we show an architectural picture that we've been working on for months and months that has every detail in it, and we show it to someone, they stop. There's too much new information coming in too fast for their visual system to match up with their cognitive processing and get it. So they just stop and say, I'm not a visual person, and put the picture aside. What I'm leading to is you can get someone to understand the complex picture if you make it through a series of builds where you start out with the basics. There are three circles. And these are this, that, and the other. And what's really interesting is where they intersect. And what's really cool is the way those two intersect. Got it? Okay. But what's really truly interesting is this piece over here and the way it's going to intersect with this piece over here. And before you know it, you've gotten them to the complicated picture and they got it. Whereas if I had just showed you this from the beginning, your brain would have said, I don't like the picture. I know that doesn't really answer your question, but if you can create it over a series of builds, your audience will get it, regardless of how complicated it may be.
Well, it sounds like that every time you see a picture, have this tendency of thinking that it's a story that's behind the picture. Because every time the picture's showing up, it's like if we're storytelling aspect. And I see when you do your presentation and everything, storytelling is a very important part of visual drawing a napkin idea.
So. Yeah. Well, here's something that I'll often think is, you know, certainly the world's greatest literature tends not to have pictures in it. You know, the books that are really fun to read, pick anyone, I don't know, Harry Potter, or Shogun, pick any book. There are no pictures in there. Well, there may be a couple, I guess, in Harry Potter, but they don't really help. They kind of hinder us from getting through it. And what I'm thinking is, I don't know this, but my guess would be when an author is writing something, they see the picture in their mind's eye, and they're going to give you just enough detail so that you can interpret the picture the way you want. And that's fantastic in the case of literature. The pictures that I'm talking about is I do not want you to interpret it. I want you to understand exactly what I'm talking about. There are exactly three pieces, especially I'm the project manager and you're the team, and you have to go execute, and we've got 48 hours to do it. I don't want you to interpret what my suggestion was. You know, if I'm the project manager, I'm now God, and this is what I want you to do. I've drawn it in a way you can't help but understand what you're supposed to do. So if you want people to interpret and click in their own mind's eye what it might be, maybe sometimes it is better to use words and let it take over. I'm not sure how that goes directly to your storytelling, but you don't always need pictures, but pictures certainly convey a lot of story on their own.
I want to remind our audience we're listening to Dan Rome, best-selling author of Back of the Napkin, who's talking to us about solving problems and presenting ideas with simple pictures. And Dan, I just today's Wall Street Journal had, I think, two, maybe three articles on the op-ed pages regarding entrepreneurship and how entrepreneurialism is what's going to take us eventually out of our morass, economic morass we're in. And it just seems to me, and maybe just to appreciate some comments that you would have about where innovation here just seems like this would be unleashed, if you will. So do you want to just talk a little bit about the role and the relationship to innovation and how this works?
Yes. And I'm actually glad you asked me that at the end. There is a long answer, but I'll give you the short one. It seems to me, having had the opportunity to work with a lot of businesses, in fact, in a lot of different countries, that there are a number of underlying mega trends that are taking place, regardless of the economic meltdown, that indicate that our ability to communicate more effectively through pictures is only going to become more and more important. And one of those would be globalization. The fact is, with a project team today, it's very likely that you will be working with someone remotely who does not speak your language or it is not their native language. And the use of a picture is a fantastic way to simply transcend the language barrier. Another aspect of it is simply information overload that we face. Information overload's a given. It's not going to go away. It's only going to get worse. But being able to think things through visually and model them out does help us cut through a lot of the noise to get to the more important signal. And this, and your final one, this notion of we've got to innovate our way out of this. There is no, in my opinion, there is no faster way to discover what was an invisible idea than trying to draw out what you already know. Now, I know that that doesn't make a lot, that doesn't sound perfect, but let me rephrase it. By putting your pen to a piece of paper and working through the idea with these simple circles, you are guaranteed to see things that you would not have seen if you just talked about it. And that is a neurobiological fact. And I think that, as we're looking for new ideas, our ability to draw them out as a starting point is going to become just super important for us for that reason.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
I think you kind of hit on the question I had, which was about remote teams,
yeah,
virtual projects. So the thing that comes to mind, that's how I run my day-to-day work. What are some of the techniques you've found that you can use that facilitate this? Because I'm my head's spinning about how I apply this to my team tomorrow. And the tools that are available to most of us aren't, we don't all have Macs, we don't all have the sketch pad. You know, what have you seen work?
You have asked the perfect question, because now I get to redeem myself in the eyes of Microsoft. You might ask, what application am I using to draw these quirky little pictures for you live? This is PowerPoint. PowerPoint has within it something, the only standing ovation I've ever gotten was at Microsoft when I pointed out to them something I had found. In PowerPoint, this works remotely. If you want to go to WebEx or any one of the virtual connection systems that allow you to have a conference call and share computers at the same time, and I have done this, I've done half-day workshops with people around the world, it's magnificent and it is so easy. Use PowerPoint as you normally would. Go into presentation mode. The only reason nobody knows these tools exist is because they're only available in presentation mode. Go into presentation mode in PowerPoint. And now watch. You see these crazy little icons down here in the bottom that pop up when I roll over them? They're in everybody's version of PowerPoint, but nobody ever uses them. Select the pen, and all of a sudden you have these drawing tools. This is nothing more than garden variety off-the-shelf PowerPoint, and it works remotely. And now all of a sudden imagine that you're having a call with someone who's in Asia. And you start out with a blank page, and you say to them, okay, you know, here's the thing that we're going to build. It's going to look like this. And it's got an H on it and a plug coming out the back because it's hybrid electric. They're seeing you draw that picture at the same time that they're hearing it. It's magic. All of a sudden, you can have a half-day conference call, whereas before, everybody's asleep. They're not. It's really amazing, and it's just good old PowerPoint.
Hi. I had a question. In communication, are verbal analogies the same as a visual expression of a problem?
What do you mean exactly? Can you give me an example?
With the economy, it would be like a car that's broken down and somebody
sure.
has to fix it.
Right.
So that's the verbal analogy, but the visual analogy would be a car that's not good, you know, that's not working. So
I think they're perfectly aligned.
Okay.
And in fact, I think what I often find myself doing, and this is something that didn't make it into the book and certainly didn't make it into the talk tonight, but one of the most powerful things that we do have, if we're trying to come up with a pictorial way of representing the problem so we can come up with a pictorial way of representing a solution or finding a solution, is to draw a visual, to draw out the broken down car. Or, you know, we use visual analogies for everything. You know, we talk remote communication systems are a bridge from one place to another. You know, there's my bridge. They're infinite. And what I've often found is a lot of these analogies will be drawn directly from engineering. I mean, we'll build a road between us. We need to open the channels of communication. We need to build a bridge between us. I mean, every one of those is automatically a picture. And you want to be careful, because one of the things that happens in a corporate environment or a big, you know, even in a political environment, is there is a tendency for us to get so in love with our pictures that we literally, they get too cute. And then the CEOs and the directors reject them because they look like they're too funny. So you want to be really careful. But the analogies, as long as they're not pushed too far, work extremely well. And they're actually a great way to come up with your first picture.
Yes. Just a quick question about where you take your skill that you have and where we might take it when we get it. I imagine you use this skill to communicate with on the back of a napkin on a daily basis. So you must have very advanced skills in knowing how to do this. And I wonder if you have been able to take it another step where you're not thinking through visually for the purpose of writing or communicating to other people, but in order to simplify and solve problems of your own mentally, where
yeah.
you can create these pictures in your head without having to write. Can you take this skill that far?
Yes.
Because that can change the world.
You really could. And in fact, you know, there are so many things we could talk about on that note, but one of them that's really fascinating is it appears that through functional MRI studies that can now be done, where you can measure someone's brain activity while they're doing something. It used to be that when you wanted to take an MRI to find out where brain activity is, you had to have the person lie down in this enormous machine, so they couldn't actually do anything. And you'd ask them to think of a color, and then you'd see where brain activity was, or you'd ask them to think, what is love, and you'd measure where brain activity is. With fMRIs, you can now have the person actually do some activities. And it starts to turn out that when we visualize something, doing something, or we visualize an object, a flower or a car, and we really, really close our eyes, we really see it in there, it appears that we may be activating exactly the same neurons and structure as if we were actually seeing that flower or doing that particular thing. Now, there's a lot of debate on that, but the point is, certainly this we know. The world out there around us exists, but our perception of it is entirely in here. The fact that I'm seeing you is happening in here. It's not actually happening. Now, if my mind has the ability to create this picture that I'm seeing right now in here and make me believe it's real, imagine how much power it has to then create images that it's going to kind of project back out about how things might be. What we can see in here has got to be almost as powerful as what we see coming out. So, I mean, we get almost metaphysical at that point, but the power of what we have. I mean, think about what a dream is. A dream can seem very real, but the thing didn't actually happen. Our mind might not know the difference. I know we didn't go where you wanted, but I find it fascinating anyway.
So So, Dan, we have reached the time or the moment in our program where we've gone, and I guess except for the maybe one or two red pens that did show up tonight, and I don't know, this program may not attract them. I think for the rest of us, as one of the people in the audience said, our heads are kind of swimming with the possibilities and so forth that all of this introduces. And it really is kind of common sense, which we like to say here at this forum is not always common practice. But I'd like to leave you with a minute or so to, as we all take a deep breath and you do too, what would you like to leave us with in terms of, perhaps besides buy your book, but what would you like to leave us with as we go forth and ponder this further?
I think the best conclusion would be, number one, this solving problems with pictures actually works. And all we have to do to prove it is try it. And all I would recommend to anybody is that it doesn't matter what the problem is. The next time you're sitting at your desk, at home or at work, and something doesn't, you want to try to figure out how to do something, just try pulling out a pen and a paper. And if what comes out is words, that's fine. But try drawing these simple circles and arrows connecting them. And then you will start to find that there is some value in that, and you will get better at doing it. It's just practicing it. We haven't done it, most of us, since we were six. And once you start doing it, you find it's very hard not to draw those pictures anymore.
Can we put our hands together for Dan Rome again,
please?
Thank
you. Thank you. Appreciate that.
I want to thank Dan Rome, the best-selling author of Back of a Napkin, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.